On Wednesday of this week, the notifications on my phone started exploding. I must have gotten, I don't exaggerate, 5, 6, 7 different notifications letting me know that O.J. Simpson had died. I don't know if this happened to you, but it was like the world was ending. It was a very dramatic moment. It actually got me thinking a little bit about O.J., and if you don't know who O.J. Simpson is, the brief recap is he was a very famous running back for the Buffalo Bills, went on to be a very successful actor, wildly popular throughout America, and then in the 1990s, there was his wife and her friend were murdered, and he was accused of that murder. There was a criminal trial, he was acquitted. There was a civil trial, he lost the civil trial. It's all very complicated. The moral of the story, the reason this came to mind, is I remember in the 90s, I was in school at the time, but I was at least alive in the 90s. I remember in the 90s that while the O.J. Simpson trial was going on, it was like the talk of the town. I don't know what was happening in Wisconsin, but in Virginia, like that's all anybody talked about. And I remember everybody wanted to know what everybody else thought. Hey, you know, what's your opinion? Do you think he's guilty? Do you think he's innocent? Did you watch the trial? This might have happened because this is one of the first, like, nationally televised trials that I can remember, and so you could follow the whole story by watching TV. So just constant conversation. And I remember that I wasn't a huge football fan at that time, and I had seen O.J. in like the Naked Gun movies. That was kind of it, and so I didn't really care too much. And so people would say, "Hey, what do you think about the O.J. Simpson trial?" And I would say, "You know, I haven't watched any of it. I don't really care about it that much. You know, it's, what do you want me to do?" And they would say, "Yeah, but what's your opinion? Like, what do you think?" And I would say, "Well, as I mentioned, I don't have any evidence. Like, I haven't watched the trial, and I'm not a legal scholar. I don't know any. I don't have an opinion." And they would look at me like I was crazy. Because, like, it's like our God-given right as Americans, right, to have opinions about things on which we are not informed. And so it was like this constant, I had this conversation 100 times over the course of those 3-4 months. I don't have an opinion. I don't care. Yeah, but what do you think? Leave me alone, people. Like, leave me alone. Okay, so here's why this came back to me, because Proverbs 18:2, we read this morning, says, "A fool takes no pleasure in understanding, only in expressing personal opinion." And I thought, wow, not to cast shade on all those people that wanted me to have an opinion, but it strikes me there's something profound about that, right? A wise person wants to understand things. A foolish person just wants to share what they think, whether they are informed or not. And there are plenty of other spaces in my life where I am very happy to exercise my personal opinion without information. It strikes me that this is, in many ways, sort of characteristic of our culture, right? And we have a whole culture in our nation kind of around this idea of expressing your personal opinion, whether it's informed or not. I don't know how often you or someone you know have posted to Facebook or X or Instagram something that was controversial, but my guess is you have never gone to one of those sites and said, "Ooh, I'm going to come here for a deep understanding of a subject area," right? No, you go there because you want to hear what everybody thinks, right? And you want to share what you think. My sense is this is a little bit about how our political climate works, isn't it? Like, I don't have time to pay careful attention to all of the complex issues facing our nation, but I have opinions on all of them, and they're very strong, right? And I think this is also how a lot of our relationships work, don't they? Like, with our friends, with our siblings, with our spouses. Hey, I'm not really interested in understanding, but I do want to get across what I think. A fool takes no pleasure in understanding, but only in expressing personal opinion. I think we could do a whole sermon on Proverbs 18:2, but I think it actually is indicative of something larger and more significant that we face as a people. Richard Rohr says in his book, Adam's Return, quote, "A gathering of American teachers told me recently that in their high school classes, Students are not at all interested in writing papers or doing research on objective information. Rather, they just want to give their feelings and opinions on data and information. They love to say what they like and do not like about things, as if everybody should care. We are inflating the youthful ego in ways that will not serve them well during the rest of their lives, in marriage and relationships and in future job performance and in the search for God. Western and comfortable people everywhere have a strong sense of deserved entitlement. This idea that everybody should care about my opinion, whether it's informed or not, I think gets to the heart of what Richard is saying is a deeper problem. It's a deeper problem of this sense of self that governs how we think of our lives and our world. Proverbs talks about this further. Proverbs says, not only do we have to be concerned with those who are obsessed with sharing their opinions, those same people tend to covet what others have. Those same people tend to think life is about owning and keeping rather than giving what's owed to others. Those same people live self-indulgent lives. The danger that Proverbs describes is the danger of a life about me, right? A life where I am of supreme importance. G. Gordon Liddy was one of the men arrested in the Watergate scandal, and he has a famous quote. He says, "I have found within myself all I need and all I ever shall need. I am a man of great faith, but my faith is in George Gordon Liddy. I have never failed me." I think the worst idol, the most dangerous false god, the most dangerous form of false religion is one where I am the God that I worship. And I think it's one that we struggle with profoundly as people. John Tyson says, that's why in these five shifts of maturity, the shift from self to others is the most difficult. It's because selfishness feels really good at first. I think we all start out self-centered. I've said this before. I had three children. In the course of raising those children, not one time did they ever wake up in the middle of the night hungry, check the time, think about how inconvenient it would be for me to get up to give them a bottle and go back to sleep, right? We start out self-centered, and that's okay. It's a survival mechanism. It's a good thing. But the goal of the life of the Christian is to grow into maturity, right? And to grow out of that self-centeredness. But it's so attractive. I like being focused on things that affect me. I like thinking about how popular I am or how much money I have or how successful I am or my opinions. I like me. I think everybody kind of does. By the way, I know there are many, many people who struggle with depression in all of its forms. And in no way do I want to belittle the significance of that disease. But I think depression is just another form of this self-obsession, right? You can be self-centered like me and be consumed with how great you are, or you can be self-centered a different way and be consumed about how terrible you are or how miserable your life is. But in both those situations, you are at the center of your worldview, right? St. Augustine says, this is the source of sin. It's love which is designed to be for the other and becomes curved in on itself. C.S. Lewis says the same thing. He says, almost the main work of life is to become out of ourselves, out of the little dark prison we are all born in. The danger is of coming to love the prison. And I think this is a particular danger for us. I think our American culture today in so many ways tells us to love the prison of ourselves. Tells us that a self-centered, self-obsessed, self-indulgent, self-opinionated focus is a good thing. And the idea that your life could be shaped by your obligations to others, to your community, to your friends, to your family, to your church, to your nation, to your God, is kind of a stunning concept. So in the midst of a world that is overwhelmingly encouraging us to live this self-focused life, Jesus calls us to something different. And I think we get this articulated beautifully in the story with James and John. I don't know if you noticed the difference. There's one big difference between the story in Mark and the story in Matthew. In Mark, James and John come to Jesus and ask for the privilege of sitting at his right and left hand in his glory. Who asked the question in Matthew? Did you notice? It's his mom. It's their mom. I love this. This is like the ultimate indignity, right? I'm going to a job interview, and mom, would you come with me and please tell the boss what a great job I'll do and why they should hire me? I think James and John's mom is like the first helicopter parent, right? Love it. Okay, anyway, other than that, I think this moment is critical. I think their mom and James and John are seeking this same self-centered life that our world has always told us is what we're supposed to do. Get what you can for yourselves. And Jesus says, hey, you're valuing the wrong things for the wrong reasons. That if you want to be like me, if you want to be like God, you have to give up of yourself. You have to move the focus from yourself to everybody else. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. This is our working definition as a church of what the word love means. Love is wanting good for another at my expense, right? Wanting good for another at my expense. Recognizing that in some situations, the other, whether that's God or other people, is more important than me. Jesus is the perfect example of this, right? Jesus is the one who literally leaves heaven and becomes human for the sake of humanity. He gives up of himself and his divinity so that he could love us and let us know that we are loved. But that calling of giving up of ourselves to love the other is fundamental to the Christian faith. It's fundamental to this idea of spiritual maturity. And it's a process that we all have to go through at some point if we want to progress into the image of Jesus. One of my favorite books is a book called Saint Maybe by Ann Tyler. I mentioned it before. Saint Maybe is, boy, it's just a heart-wrenching book. But in one section of the book, there's a young man named Ian Bedloe. And Ian is in the worst situation of his life. And in a low moment, he wanders into this random, dinky-looking church in a part of town he's never been to before. And it's a small congregation in a small room, and they have a worship service which is different than what he's ever experienced before. And at one point, the pastor says to the whole congregation, you know, what do you need forgiveness? And he is overwhelmingly clear about the answer to that question. At the end of the service, everybody gets up to leave, and he gets cornered by the pastor. This is like every first-time guest's nightmare, right? The pastor comes up, and the pastor says, not just, hey, glad you were here, but how did it go with the prayer that you prayed? And he's like, what are you talking about? And the pastor says, you know, the prayer for forgiveness. What did you ask God to forgive you about? And he's like, wait a minute, is this even legal? Like, are pastors allowed to ask this? Isn't there some confidentiality clause? But Ian says in the moment, instead of running away, his heart starts beating really, really fast, like he's going to do something brave. And then he starts to answer the question. He says, in a voice not quite his own, I caused my brother to kill himself. The pastor's name is Reverend Emmett, gazes at him thoughtfully. Ian continues, I told him his wife was cheating on him, and now I'm not even sure she was. I mean, I'm pretty sure she did in the past, and I know I wasn't totally wrong, but so he drove into a wall. And then his wife died of sleeping pills, and I guess you could say I caused that too, more or less. Here he paused because Reverend Emmett might want to disagree with him, but Reverend Emmett just rocks from heel to toe and listens. So it looks as if my parents are going to have to raise the children, Ian said. Had he mentioned there were children? Everything's been dumped on my mom, and I don't think she's up to it. Her or my dad, either one. I don't think they'll ever be the same after this. And my sister's busy with her own kids, and I'm away at college most of the time. And as he's staring into the eyes of this pastor, he starts to relax, and he says, "So anyhow, that's what I asked for in that prayer. And I honestly believe it might have worked. Oh, it's not like I got an answer in plain English, but I have this feeling. I think, I don't know, don't you? Don't you think I'm forgiven?" And the pastor looks at him and says, "Goodness, no." He says, "Oh, but I thought that was kind of the point. I thought that God forgives everything." "He does," Reverend Emmett said, "but you can't just say, 'I'm sorry, God.' Well, anyone can do that much. You have to offer reparation, concrete, practical reparation, according to the rules of our church." "But what if there isn't any reparation? What if it's something nothing will fix?" "Well, that's where Jesus comes in, of course." Another itchy word, Jesus. Ian averts his eyes. "Jesus remembers how difficult life on earth can be," Reverend Emmett told him. "He helps with what you can't undo, but only after you've tried to undo it." "Tried? Tried how?" asked Ian. "What would it take?" At this point, Reverend Emmett starts collecting hymnals from the pew as though the answer is so obvious he doesn't even need to think about it. "Well, first, you'll need to see about those children," he says. Ian says, "Okay, but see about them in what way exactly?" "Why, raise them, I suppose." "Huh?" Ian said. "But I'm only a freshman." Reverend Emmett turned to face him. "I'm away in Pennsylvania most of the time," Ian told him. "Then maybe you should drop out." "Drop out?" "Right. Drop out of college." "Right." Ian stared at him. "This is some kind of test, isn't it?" he said finally. Reverend Emmett nodded, smiling. Ian sags with relief. "It's God's test," Reverend Emmett told him. "God wants to know how far you'll go to undo the harm you've done." "But he wouldn't really make me follow through with it," Ian said. "How else would he know then?" "Wait," Ian said. "You're saying God would want me to give up my education, change all my parents' plans for me, and give up my education?" "Yes, if that's what is required." "But that's crazy. I'd have to be crazy. What kind of cockeyed religion is this?" Reverend Emmett says, "It's the religion of atonement and complete forgiveness. It's the religion of the second chance." One of my favorite scenes in any book I've ever read. This idea that if we want to journey from who we were in our self-obsessed lives, in our small sins or in our great sins, it requires believing that other people are like more important than us. It requires us to give up of ourselves in some dramatic ways so that we can elevate others above me. That's what maturity means for the Christian. It means recognizing that I'm just not that important. Two tools, I think, that are helpful for us in this journey. Briefly, two ways that I think we can work on that transition from self to others. The first one is, we call it humility, this idea that I need to come to a deeper personal recognition of my relative value. We get some difficult moments in this story with Jesus and James and John. We get some difficult moments in the story of Ian Bedloe where we get called out. "Hey, we're going to bring the other 10 guys in. We're going to tell them what you asked for. And we're going to explain why it was wrong." Richard Rohr says, "Every master's lesson, every parable or spiritual riddle, every confounding question is intended to bring up the limitations of our own wisdom, our own power, our tiny self. The master gives us a dose of humiliation to determine whether we are even at kindergarten level yet. If you immediately balk at a minor ego humiliation, the master knows no basic transformation has taken place yet. Part of the challenge of the Christian life is to say, hey, I need places where I recognize my smallness. And sometimes that happens in the midst of our sin or our brokenness where we feel our smallness intensely. Sometimes we need to recognize our smallness even when life is going kind of well. Philip Brooks says, the true way to be humble is not to stoop until you are smaller than yourself, but to stand at your real height against some higher nature that will show you what the real smallness of your greatness is. To stand at your real height against some higher nature that will show you what the real smallness of your greatness is. That's what the life of the Christian is about. It's about recognizing that at my best, I am so incredibly short of the standard that Christ sets, that I could not possibly be the hero of this story. I could not possibly be the main event. I can't be the most important person in my life. And when I begin to recognize that, when I recognize the smallness of my greatness, when I recognize that I am not king, then the kingdom has the best chance of breaking through. The second thing I think that's so helpful for us as we work on our transition from self to other is the process of of entering into people's stories. We usually use the word incarnation in the Christian church. Incarnation refers to Jesus, God the Son, becoming Jesus, human and God, and living our earthly life. But we incarnate like Christ when we enter into the stories of the people around us and allow those stories to affect our lives. This is one of the reasons why I value our mission experiences, whether it's going to serve in Bridge Street Mission in Wausau, whether it's going to serve in Costa Rica or anywhere in between. There is an experience that happens when we enter into the lives of people who have wildly different situations than us. It begins to change our relative importance. In 2018, our church took a trip to Haiti, and Haiti at that time was less chaotic than it is now, but it was still the poorest nation in our hemisphere. It was in that season where the Zika virus was a big deal. If you remember the Zika virus, it was transmitted by mosquitoes, and the real fear was that either mothers who were pregnant or maybe young babies, I think mothers who were pregnant were bitten with a virus. They could have malformed heads. Their heads didn't grow to full size, which brought all kinds of cognitive delays. When we were in Haiti, our church was running a medical clinic, and we had all these patients coming through. And one patient was a family with a baby. Her name was Estella. And baby Estella, we're pretty sure, had been affected by the Zika virus. Her head was not to size for a baby her age. They brought baby Estella to us first because she had a very high fever and illness, and so our medical team treated her for that disease, and that was the first day of the week that we were there. The last day of the week we were there, the family came back, and the great news was that Estella was healthy. She was no longer had a fever. She didn't have whatever infection was raging in her body beforehand. But then at the end of that reunion with Estella, the family started speaking. Most of us didn't speak Creole. We didn't understand. So afterwards, our translators explained. They said, hey, we will not be able to care for this baby. We know something is wrong beyond just the infection you were able to cure. We know that we can't handle this ourselves. Would you please take her with you when you go? And even though we didn't understand at the moment, I got to tell you, there is nothing as overwhelming as imagining yourself in the shoes of a parent who says, I can't care for my child, and so I'm going to give them away to strangers in hopes that you could do a better job. How do I return to a life in Wisconsin and live the way I used to live when I know that Estella's parents are still out there trying to care for her? How do I pretend in a world with Estella's that my selfish interests and passions and uninformed opinions and pursuit of success matters at all. Here's the thing, you don't have to go to Haiti to enter into someone else's story. You can have a sibling who's having a rough week. You can have a coworker or a teammate or a neighbor. You can enter into the story of a person who's serving you coffee or bagging you groceries. And when you do, if for a moment you consider that their story might be more important than yours at this moment, you start acting and looking and living like Jesus. We start imagining what it means if we have a life that's about others before myself. One of my favorite stories comes from Ernest Gordon's true account of a World War II Japanese prison camp. It's called Through the Valley of the Kwai. And in it, he tells how he's a Scottish captain who was captured by the Japanese. He tells about how this camp of prisoners of war who were building the Burma Railway for the Japanese had... things in the camp got ugly,
right.
And there became a little bit of a dog-eat-dog mentality where everyone was just trying to survive, right? Where fellow POWs would steal from each other and cheat each other. Men would sleep on their packs and yet have them stolen from underneath their heads in the middle of the night. Survival was everything. Until the story of this Scottish soldier named Angus McGillivray. I'm just going to call him Angus. Until the story of Angus got told. So Angus was this big, honking, strong Scottish soldier. And the Scots had this pattern. When they became POWs, they got a buddy. They called him their mucker. I don't know why they called him their mucker. The Scottish soldiers took their devotion to their mucker very seriously. And Angus's mucker, his buddy, was seriously ill, and it looked as though not much could be done. Someone had stolen his blanket. He was malnourished. He was at what looked like the end of his earthly life. But Angus was determined that he was not going to lose his buddy. So Angus gave his mucker his blanket, and he said he had just come across an extra one. Likewise, at every mealtime, Angus would give his rations to his friend, ask him to eat them, and stand over him and saying, "Don't worry, I'm able to get extra food." Angus did everything he could possibly do to make sure his buddy would recover. But as his mucker started to recover, Angus started to get weaker. And ultimately, Angus, one day, just suddenly, out of nowhere, collapses, slumps over, and dies. The doctors discovered he had died of starvation, complicated by exhaustion. He had been giving of his own food and shelter. He had given everything he had, even his very life. Greater love has no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. As word circulated about why Angus died in this POW camp, the behavior of the men in that camp began to change. Suddenly, guys began to focus on their friends and their mates and people beyond themselves. Something more than survival took over. They began to pool their talents. There was a violin maker. There was an orchestra leader. There was a cabinet maker. There was a professor. And soon, the camp began to pool those skills, and they had an orchestra of homemade instruments and a church called the Church Without Walls, that was so powerful and compelling that even Japanese guards attended. They began their own little school and library and hospital all in this POW camp, all because one man named Angus gave all he had for his friend. For many of the men in that camp, this turnaround meant survival. Tim Hansel says, "What happened is an awesome illustration of the potential unleashed when one person actually gives it all away." That's the story of Jesus, right? The story of Jesus is what happens when one man actually gives it all away, when he says, "I will not allow this story to be just about me," when he says that love is wanting good for another, even at great expense to myself. What if that was the characteristic that most defined us as mature believers in Christ? What if we were a people that let others' stories take over our own? What if we just decided we're not that important? And the people around us and the God with us is of supreme importance. Then perhaps we discover that one person who makes the shift from self to others can literally change the world. Thanks be to God. Amen.